She stayed home the second day, too, because the flow suddenly, and quite surprisingly for the first time, her mother said, became heavy, and with it came such aches. Her whole body ached. It was like having the flu without any fever. She would get used to it, Mrs. Colby said, but Marcella didn't think so, staying in bed nearly all day. She read the continued story in Ladies' Home Journal, but the last installment hadn't come yet, so she didn't know how it ended. She pored over the sanitary napkin ads, she'd never read them before, and passed Kotex's Are You in the Know test successfully, which made her feel good. She tried to comfort herself by reading the Saturday Evening Post cartoons, but she was not comforted. It was so awful, menstruating, and unclean. Even the Bible said so, unclean, along with the cloven-footed and the swine, the mouse and the ferret, along with scales and plague and especially leprosy. Ugh, and nothing she could do about it. Nothing. It was like knowing you were going to be sick, month after month after month, and not being able to play and having people make fun of you. She couldn't believe how bad it was. Mrs. Colby told her she should get out of bed. She couldn't possibly be having cramps. She was too young for that. That came when you got older. But Marcella stayed in bed, curled up into a ball and hugging herself, feeling better in that position than any other day, any other way. And on the eighth day, she shall take unto her two turtles or two young pigeons, and the priest shall offer the one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering. Saturday morning was one of the happiest days of her life. She had no period at all Friday afternoon, so her Kotex was still white when she went to bed. But Mrs. Colby said she better wear it anyway, because there was no sense getting the sheets all messy. Then Saturday morning the napkin was still white, but Mrs. Colby said, better wait and see. Marcella waited until she'd eaten her cereal and toast, then ran upstairs. Still white. She was finished. All done, through, and could go outside and climb trees and play and everything. She climbed into her jeans, oh, how good they felt, and ran outdoors in the sunshine. First, she rode her bike all around the block, twice, fast. After that, she thought about roller skating, but decided to wait until afternoon, and she climbed up into the big elm in her treehouse. She lay flat on her stomach and looked down, watching her mother come out and pin a few clothes to the line, her mother not seeing her. Marcella giggling but holding it back. Watching old Mrs. Schneider next door out hoeing the garden. Remembering the ways that old lady would slaughter her chickens, how she would grab one right around its head, twisting its neck like a big cable. Swift as lightning, her black shoe on its head. Smash! Worn sole of a high-top shoe. Smash! The chicken's cheek into the ground and chop! Blood shooting through the air. Big blobs hitting the ground and gathering the dust to them, like the first big drops of summer rain make little pools of mud. Only this blood mud. And the chicken, oh, still alive. Headless chickens scampering around the yard, and the blood slowing, until they were just spattered snow-white chickens with red holes where heads had been, red gaping holes, and their white feathers all spattered with drops of blood. Lying on her back, looking up, up, through the lacy layers of spring leaves, the light making them almost translucent but green, and the branches dark, until she tired of that, too. Maybe she would roller skate after all. She was walking across the backyard toward the house when she felt it. There, she felt it. It was like the same thing that happens to your stomach when you go over a steep hill, a dropping, inside, only not in the stomach, down, lower. She was almost certain, began to run, slamming through the black back screen, across the wooden porch, and finally through the bathroom door onto the toilet. But she didn't even have to look to know, so she sat down before she spread wide to see. There it was, blood, all red and still wet, in a big stain the shape of an almond. Oh, a very large almond, lying right in the center of the oh-so-pure-white panties, the Sunday ones she'd put on today to celebrate Sunday's child as good and gay, with the two hearts and an arrow going straight through them. Again! Again! But her mother had promised her it would be 28 days. Promised! So maybe then she wasn't really through, she wasn't finished yet, not until Sunday, just like her mother said, with the full skirt and the tight elastic and the pin coming undone no matter how carefully she fixed it, and everyone could tell every 28 days for the rest of her whole life until she was old, old as Grandma, as old as Mrs. Schneider, all shriveled up and gray and almost dead. There it is again.
Wow. That's really a fine piece of writing.
Thank you.
Really. Mm. I was very moved by it, even though I've heard it a lot of times. And you, and I, if I can presume to say so, you were very moved by it, judging from your face as you read.
Yeah, well, I usually get back into the space I write from when
yeah.
I read.
Yeah. You also read beautifully. You really do. I think all those beatnik days paid off.
All that practice.
You do. You read beautifully.
Thank you.
Oh, let's see now. What did I want to ask you? I know. One thing I thought when you started reading it, it's very hard now to think about young girls knowing so little about their bodies and about menstruation. For example, everything about their bodies, but particularly menstruation, which is the first blow, the first huge change that a young girl goes through as she grows up. And I found myself feeling kind of disbelieving in the beginning as you were reading, thinking, oh, it couldn't be true that there are girls today still who know so little when it, and whose mothers sit them down and tell them in such an incredibly puzzling way.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that's not true. I know there are girls like that still.
Well, quite possibly, though, you know, the time setting for this was just post-World War II. And
right.
People, in fact, were more innocent then
uh-huh.
of these things. And but also, this book's been taught in classes, and I know because I've known the teachers that taught it, that sometimes the students are, in fact, puzzled by this character. How could she have been so innocent? How could she have known so little? So my feeling is that...
maybe it's not true anymore.
That, well, at least in some segments of society, that is phasing out, and this is already a thing of the past, a historical novel in a way.
But it was...
That's good.
Yeah, but it was true. And I think of... I found myself thinking of my daughter, Suki,
mm-hmm.
and who's 10, who is just 10, and who read... our bodies ourselves with me and without me as early as 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And who still I know because she's 10, because you just, no matter how bright you may be or what material your mother might give you to read, it's hard to grasp certain things at certain ages, I think.
Oh,
who
sure.
still doesn't really have an understanding about everything to do with women and bodies and sex and reproduction, etc. But who knows, you know, who knows so much
anyway.
More, so much more than Marcella did.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing that I was thinking was, I was wondering, I wanted to make sure that we said that those journals that you started keeping, the diary you started keeping at 11, I'm so impressed with the fact that you more or less never stopped it, and you have these racks of loose leaf books on a shelf in your office.
That's true.
With journals kept for all of those years,
yes.
all the way through now.
Yes.
And that when you were writing Marcella, did you referred back to them?
Oh, yeah, I do that from time to time, particularly when I want to get a sense of where my head was at during a particular period of time, and then the diaries are very useful
right.
to go back to.
Because you might be able to remember the facts, but not the way it felt.
Well, yeah, right. And facts, of course, you can get out of the library.
Right. Right. Okay, so let's see. We were up to the point where you wrote Marcella, and since then, what's happened with your writing career?
Well, since then, I've continued to write. I'm working on a second novel now, which I think I mentioned, and I wrote a piece about some mass murderers in Nebraska, Charlie Starkweather and Carol Ann Fugate. I wrote it because a movie had come out that was based on them, and it brought them back to mind.
Because you had been there at the time.
Right. I had been not on the spot in terms of the murders, but in the town that it happened in. So I wrote a memoir of what it was like to be in college and have in Lincoln, Nebraska, and have these mass murders going on. I think there were 11 people killed by the time the pair was captured. And it was published in Atlantic Monthly, and very well received, a lot of comment, a lot of attention, and it made me begin to think in terms of writing, of using my journalistic background more than I had been. The poetry and the short stories and the fiction don't really call upon all of that training, but the Starkweather piece did, mm-hmm. and since then I've begun writing a series of essays. I've finished one, a piece about the dust storms of the 1930s in the Great Plains area. I thought it would be a relatively interesting and simple piece to do. I found out the research job on it was enormous, but fascinating, and I spent months doing the research and then months writing. Mm-hmm. And it is now in the process of being circulated. It will be published soon, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And I envision doing more articles, essays along this line, and eventually collecting them and having them as a book. Mm-hmm. And I'm very happy about that.
Do you see yourself in any way as a regional writer?
Well,
it's hard.
No, I really don't. I guess I really don't, because the novel that I'm working on now is very much set in New York City and has practically no sense of the area that I came from mm-hmm. in it, or if it does, it's certainly indirect. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the poetry does not come out of the Midwest, but certainly a lot of my writing does, and I'm sure will continue to. Mm-hmm. I feel I have two homes, Alma, Nebraska, and New York City.
And how different can you get?
And I get culture shock every time I move back and forth between the two.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Right. How do you feel about writing in so many different forms? When I was writing, which I did for a lot of my life, I went through a somewhat similar process to yours, as you know. Mm-hmm. Poetry for a long time, then short stories, then long fiction, mm-hmm. and then some nonfiction. And I found every time I changed to a new form, it was very, very difficult for me to get back into writing the other. The most stark, of course, being the change from poetry to prose. Mm-hmm. And ever since I started writing prose, after 10 years of poetry, I have not really been able to write poetry again. I did write a number of poems after I started writing prose, but I would get confused in even understanding whether what I was writing was a poem, whereas that had come instinctually before. Mm-hmm. And it was very difficult for me to keep a hold of those two very different forms at the same time. And I would like you to talk about how you feel with all these different forms that you move around in.
Well, I felt something of the same kind of difficulty moving from form to form in early stages, but I don't feel that at this point. I feel like now the different forms are like beautiful reliefs from one another. I just finished working on the Dust Storm piece, which was very definitely nonfiction, and uh-huh. I adored doing it. But I found when I got out, I couldn't think of going back into another piece of nonfiction right away, and I'm working very hard on my novel. And I would suspect that by the time I get through with this run of my novel, I'll be feeling the itch to move back to the new nonfiction, or perhaps some poetry, which I've continued to write.
You continue to write the poetry throughout?
Yes. Yes, mm-hmm. yes. Not with the same kind of intensity that I did in the early periods, not poem after poem after poem after poem, but they come through, they break through, I stop, I write them, it feels mm-hmm. very good. So at this point, I feel about the changing of form sort of like I feel about housework. You know, you do the dishes till you get tired of doing dishes, and then you go straighten up the front room a little bit, and then you go take a walk. And I feel that kind of very pleasant capacity to move back and forth and not be confused by the difference. But I did find it difficult at first.
Before I say the next thing, I have to say, this is WBAI in New York. Do you have a favorite, and do you have a form which you think is most natural to you or that you're best at?
Yes.
Okay.
I think that I'm a novelist by nature.
Uh-huh.
And increasingly, I think that. And I think it's in part because the way that I think or the way that I experience life is sort of complex, actually. And the space that you have to move
right.
around
right.
within a novel is just such a pleasure.
Right.
And I feel that I come closest to really saying where I'm at in the novel form.
I remember now that we had a lot of conversations about that as we changed from form to form
mm-hmm.
to form.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all so incredibly different.
Oh, they are.
The short story is so different from the novel, and it does have to do mostly with the enormous amount of space. And it's like, in terms of art, it's like the canvas being so large.
Right, a mural as opposed to a miniature painting.
Right.
Yeah.
And yet, when you're writing the miniature painting, when you're writing the short story or the vignette or the poem, particularly the poem, mm-hmm. you have to be so precise and so finely, or the edges have to be so finely turned that's an equal but different pleasure.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
I don't know what I would be able to say of myself at this point. I think my writing form at the moment is radio.
It sounds that way.
Is there any form that you feel is easiest to publish, and does that influence which one you write ever?
Well, of course, the journalism is easiest to get published, because in most cases you're working for a newspaper or magazine, and what you write is very regularly published or edited until it can get into shape so that it can be. And poetry, of course, is the most difficult to publish. There are the fewest outlets, and certainly if you're talking about paid publications, there are quite a few, very few outlets. But I don't know. I don't really think that that influences what I do to a very large degree.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get published.
Mm-hmm.
But I write things that I know will never get published because
right.
I want to write them.
Right.
And I have a file cabinet drawer full of things sitting there that may never see the light of day beyond passing them around to a few friends.
You just reminded me of what you said earlier, that the reason you started keeping your diary at 11 was because of the two realities, that the reality that your world was telling you, your mother and everyone else around
school
you.
School teachers. And
right.
Things, right.
And the reality you saw for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing I thought of that I wanted to mention when you said that was that was why I started writing too, although I wouldn't have given it exactly those words, but it was in order to keep a sense of sanity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think we used to talk about that too, and I think all writers and people talk about that is one of the main motivations for becoming a creative artist, a way to survive from whatever is out of kilter in your reality.
Yeah.
And now, what was the point I had to make in connection with this? I think I lost it. It was a real good point, too. Maybe I'll think about it. I might remember it. Oh, I wish I hadn't forgotten it. Okay, since we're on the radio, we can't stop and think.
Okay.
We have to go on. Oh, okay.
So
the easy... Oh, okay. Another question was, when you think of when you have an idea of something you want to write, does the form come along with the idea, or do you then think, is this a poem or is this a short story, or do I start a novel here?
Oh, that's an interesting. I almost always know what it is,
mm-hmm.
but I almost always start with very little evidence.
Mm-hmm.
What happens typically is a line jumps into my head, and I almost know instantly whether that line is line one of a poem or line one of a novel. Right?
It's always line one, though, right?
Well, it always seems like line one. It doesn't always end up being line one.
Uh-huh.
But it certainly is line one of the first draft.
Uh-huh.
It always is.
Right.
And I've gotten cleverer as I've worked, or at least I think I have, right? Because when the line pops into my head now, instead of dashing to a piece of paper to write it down, I question it, you know. Are you really good enough for me to get up off the bed and walk across the room? You know, what's line two? and so I have some things pop into mind, and they give uh-huh. me pleasure, and then they pass on into oblivion, and other things come through
mm-hmm.
more strongly
uh-huh.
and go to paper.
Uh-huh. Okay, let's see. Now I want to ask you about your feelings about the women's movement in relation to writing. When the women's movement began, and you were an early joiner, as I remember, of the women's
yes.
movement.
as I remember.
On last week's show, I talked about my reluctance to join it at first.
Did you?
Listeners, this is the person I was talking about who I exchanged letters with from Boston back and forth. And what do you really think about this? Because I'm thinking of joining a consciousness raising group. I talked about that last week, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what I want to know is, since the movement began and you became a feminist, how has that affected your writing?
There are two sort of things to say there. First is that it gave me a tremendous amount of support, underpinning, which I think that it did for many women, perhaps most women, that were working as artists. It gave me a tremendous sense of audience, a more explicit sense of audience than I'd ever had, or a potential audience, say. A real feeling that if I were able to write my reality, that there would be people who would read and understand it. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a tremendous, tremendous gift. But I also found, to my chagrin at first and to my amusement later, that the women's movement would sometimes team up with my censor and would act as a limiter on my own writing, which perplexed me a lot at first, and I eventually learned to get angry at it.
Wait, I don't understand how.
Well, I would be in the middle of writing something, and before I really had it written, I would start evaluating it in terms of, you know, does this toe the party line? Is this feminist writing, right? Oh. Is this going to be perceived as being pro or anti-feminist? And I found that a very inhibiting factor, and still do occasionally get trapped in it. So with that exception, I would say that the movement's been entirely good for my writing.
That's really interesting. I think I would have responded and probably did respond to that very differently a while ago than I do now. My first reaction was to say, here was my first reaction, Marilyn, as
okay.
you spoke. Really, Marilyn, but how could a person who really is a feminist, as you are, how could you write anything that would be anti-feminist
or
anti-woman?
That's my argument. That's my best argument, right, for my censor.
Okay, but I don't believe it anymore because I'm stage two feminist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a baby feminist anymore. I've been here too long. And here's what I know now, and I don't know how to say it because of the FCC regulations, but the phrase is the, what word shall I use? I use the word phallus,
mm-hmm.
and I hope that the listeners know the word I'm thinking of that starts with a P and ends with a K and has five letters. We all have the phallus in our heads.
Is a
phrase I've heard a lot, and what it means, since I've had to be so cryptic, is that all of our indoctrination and socialization of the patriarchy is inside all of us so deeply that no matter how conscious we become and how much we examine our own consciousness and our own feelings, it is still possible that we're still, unbeknownst to ourselves, expressing views and feelings and living our lives in ways that support anti-woman and anti-feminist institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And that it is possible for a woman who is as much of a feminist as she possibly or anyone possibly can be to express ideas, to write ideas, to feel ideas, and to act in ways that are anti-ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Did you
mm-hmm.
follow that?
Right.
And I find that to be a very advanced thought for myself to have come to. I don't think it's advanced so much as it's away from, I've gotten past the stage of pure illusion, not illusion, euphoria
mm-hmm.
that I was in at the beginning as a feminist.
Yeah.
And it's the problem is much more complicated.
It's very complex, isn't it?
So it is possible that you could write stuff that would be not
yeah,
good for all
I
of us
that,
from
yes,
a feminist viewpoint,
yes,
but on the other hand...
Yes. And I think that the question came up and had to be looked at and answered. Am I a feminist first and a writer second, or a writer first and a feminist second, if it should come down to a conflict here?
Mm.
And,
interesting.
Yeah, it is. And for myself, I decided that I was going to answer writer first and feminist second.
Mm-hmm.
Because I found when I tried to answer the other way around, I got really blocked.
You felt squashed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I don't want to squash you, and you're not going to believe it, but we have 5 minutes to go.
So?
I think it's terrible.
This has gone very, very fast for me.
Yeah, we had a lot more things planned to talk about and get to.
A whole pile of things.
And we have to skip now to end number one, end number two, and announcements. And even so, we can't run over because we're short of time. So
okay.
This is really abrupt to have to just shift into the end like this, and I'm sorry. But, the first thing we can do real quickly, I wanted to ask you and I want to tell people what you're working on now.
Which is
the novel.
The second novel, which is called One for the Money.
And occasional poems
and right.
books of essays
right.
and
yes.
teaching at
yes.
Pratt.
Right,
okay.
That sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. You keep yourself busy. And then Marilyn's going to read us a poem, an autobiographical poem for the last thing she'll read us tonight.
Okay. A poem about myself as a writer. entitled Cold, a poem that's been fairly heavily edited in spots so that I could read it on the air.
And as a tribute to your memory, she doesn't have anything marked up on the page. She's going to edit it as she goes along.
Right. Alone as a bone, I was born in a town so flat you could climb a tree and see clean into the next county. Cold tabletop land, I never stopped shivering even in August, the prairie sun not bold enough to heat what wanted warming in me. Grew up buried beneath a cold blue sky, surrounded by cowboys who believe book learning witchcraft or worse. Trapped, trembling, alone, shivering partly from dearth of heat, partly from a vision so strong it struck whiter than lightning in my soul, but we seemed to get on. Transient and thin, it was the only warmth I knew. I let it teach me to walk. It grew into a pillar of fire. I followed its trail, heart pounding louder than hooves on pavement, across a continent-wide sea of corn. Trek to the city of steel and stone, hardly a tree to see, so darn cold it felt like home. I put my dry roots down in cement and dog dew, did the whole bit. Husband, kids, splitting up blues, 9 to 5, that had a nervous fit or two, almost quit my dream, it wasn't quite hot anymore, but managed to fan the embers to a dull red. Alone, I began chiseling my stories out of the cold stone of my fear. Prairies breed cookies tough as hardtack. The weak ones die spontaneously, heartburn, or are scorched into silence. Those who remain stand tall and lean as phone poles bucking the wind. The sun bites deep, they bite back at it, but never gain more than a certain indomitable toughness, wrinkles riveted so deeply into face skin they become canyon gullies down which no tear dare weep. I got thin and mean. I bit off words like grenade pins, spit them out, heaped hundreds of those hot pomegranates at the world. Few exploded. I'll show them, mothers, I cried. It was the cowboy in me, the one who bows omegaed legs around the juttinous hump of the biggest, orneriest son of a Brahma bull you ever did see, and without so much as a mantra to guide him shouts, "Let her rip." Rip we did. My guts rattling like brown leaves. Spit teeth when I miscalculated and hit ground too soon, or the chisel slipped. Spit blood. But I did it. I rode true that damn dream. Souls are our only prophets. And here I am, trekking your Berkshire mountainside. I pat my marble cemetery sisters as I pass by. How well I know their cold touch. And dance. A fiery skeleton on your green lawns. Gobble down the yeasty whole grain bread of your poets. Drink the fresh spring water that flows from your musicians' fingertips in easy streamers of light. Lean into the balm of your art. Is this me? It must be. I'm still shaking. But see how these tears flow warm, how flesh begins to linger on my bones. See, I roll in the heat of your meadow, grow moss on my stone.
Thank you. We have to go very fast. I really want to thank you for coming. I've enjoyed this program immensely. And I think I wanted to make one comment about your writing, which is that the pieces you chose to read was just really showed the versatility of your writing so beautifully, and I know only showed part of it. It was wonderful having you here. I'm not going to have time to make the announcement, so a very quick one. Don't forget that on the weekend of August 13th to 14th, the Women's Department is presenting an entire weekend of programs about women and work, starting at 9 o'clock Saturday morning and going till 6:30 Sunday night. And Marilyn's book, Marcella, can be obtained at Juna Bookstore in the Village, which is 154 West 10th Street. And great, I can stop right there. Come back next week for a show with five women who are part of a women artists support group, and we're going to be talking about women being artists together and helping each other. Thanks a lot for being here, all of you, and Marilyn, and we will close with about probably 10 seconds of the theme song, which is Sister Woman, Sister. Good night.
Sister Woman, Sister, Can you still feel any pain? Or have they robbed you of your anger while putting Thorazina in your veins?
Every Woman's Space was brought to you live with a theme on recording.
Have the walls grown up so high that you can't even dream of leaving, and you've forgotten how.